This is Functional Medicine Update for May 1997, Volume 16, Number 5. Side 1 of this month's tape will feature updates on several studies, including the Finnish Smoker Study, vitamin E and red cell damage in smokers and non-smokers, selenium balance and viral disorders, Gulf War Syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, and the antioxidant properties of lactobacillus. Our clinician interview on Side 2 will be with Dr. Will Taylor, discussing his research on selenium. Also on Side 2 is a clinical focus on the pharmacological and metabolic aspects of obesity. Here with the May 1997 edition of Functional Medicine Update is Dr. Jeffrey Bland.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for May 1997. And as is always the case, it seems, with Functional Medicine Update, we have quite an ambitious schedule for this month, dealing with new aspects of viral illness and their control, a review from a series of two new clinical perspectives on antioxidants, and then we will be talking on Side 2 about how clinical focus relates to insulin insensitivity and the new thoughts around weight loss and weight management. Let's first, however, go to two hot-breaking clinical studies that I think are quite significant related to the role that supplementary antioxidants may have on oxidative risk and on prevention of oxidant-induced diseases. There's been a long-standing question that I'm sure you're aware of as a listener to Functional Medicine Update of the role that antioxidant supplements may play in helping to protect against degenerative and chronic illness. There has been a debate among fields within this spectrum of controversy that relate to whether it's the antioxidants that are vitamins, such as vitamin C, vitamin E, or carotenoid, as provitamin A, that is the principal component of the antioxidant protection, or whether it's other substances within food, polyphenols and other flavonoid-like compounds that exert antioxidant properties, that then the fruits and vegetable-rich diet, which has been associated with lowered incidence of cancer and heart disease, is contributing, therefore, more than just the vitamin antioxidants, but is also contributing other degrees and components to the antioxidant input as it relates to these phenols and flavonoids. Well, this study that I'm going to discuss was directed at trying to understand more of this differentiation between vitamin E, vitamin C, and carotenoids, and the other food-derived redox active substances, reduction oxidation active substances. In this particular study, they looked at individuals, and actually it was 142 smoking men, aged 35 to 65 years of age, and they were randomly assigned to either a supplement group, 100 milligrams of D-alpha tocopherol acetate plus 250 milligrams slow-release ascorbic acid twice a day. That would be then 500 milligrams vitamin C total, 200 milligrams vitamin E as natural D-alpha tocopherol acetate. Second group was 100 milligrams D-alpha tocopherol acetate twice a day with 250 milligrams of ascorbic acid twice a day in a non-slow-release form. The next group was 250 milligrams of slow-release ascorbic acid twice a day without any vitamin E. Next was a 30 milligram coenzyme Q10 in oil three times a day, and a 30 milligram coenzyme Q10 as granular supplementation or placebo. So this is a very extensive trial looking at a range of different types of supplementation of antioxidants, vitamin C and E in combination, vitamin C or vitamin E by themselves, sustained-release vitamin C versus granular-release vitamin C, coenzyme Q10 in oil versus coenzyme Q10 in granular form against a placebo. The outcome variable that was measured was a urinary excretion of the metabolite 8-oxo-7-8-dihydro-T2-deoxyguanosine, sometimes abbreviated 8-oxo-D-guanosine. This is a nucleoside metabolite that is related to oxidative breakdown. It's one of the better markers for free radical oxidative damage to the body in an in vitro measurement. It measures the ongoing oxidative damage to nucleic acid materials associated with oxidative stress. So taking a baseline in an individual, then measuring the effects that various therapies or exposures have on the presence of that analyte in the urine or plasma can tell you about relative differences in oxidative damage. the trial outcome in utilizing 8-oxo-guanosine, which is, by the way, a repair product of the oxidative DNA damage, was then used 2 months after supplementation versus the baseline. It was very interesting that in this supplementation, across the range of products that were used, the vitamin E, vitamin C, coenzyme Q10, and the different forms that were employed, there seemed to be a lack of antioxidant supplementation effect on the excretion rate of 8-oxo-D-guanosine. This is despite substantial increases in plasma antioxidant concentrations for the individual substances that were administered. This suggests very strongly that antioxidant effects upon the body is more than just selected antioxidants given one or even two at a time, but appears to be related to the overall influence that a diet rich in fruit and vegetables has that delivers many other oxidoreductive substances, the flavonoids and the polyphenols and other materials that are considered phytonutrients beyond that of vitamin E, vitamin C, and coenzyme Q10, which were the three things examined in the study. So I think this is a very provocative study that suggests that eating foods that are rich in fruits and vegetables is more beneficial in providing a balanced array of antioxidants that help to defend against oxidative attack to various critical biomolecules like DNA than just given selective antioxidants by themselves. This was the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 65, page 503 in 1997. This was from the Department of Pharmacology, University of Copenhagen, and the Research Institute of Public Health in Finland. It certainly will be a study that will generate, I'm sure, much discussion and probably debate among scientists and clinicians in the field. A second study, which follows the same theme, I found to be equally interesting. And in this particular study, the investigators looked at the role that vitamin E and vitamin C given in supplementary doses had on a red cell membrane damage, another measure of peroxidative oxidative stress. So the first study I mentioned used as the biomarker 8-deoxyguanosine, and the second study as its biomarker for oxidative stress, oxidative damage to erythrocyte membranes. In this particular study, they gave vitamin E and vitamin C in graded doses to smokers and non-smokers and looked at the impact that it had on oxidative damage to the red cell membrane. The results were quite surprising and certainly by intuition would not have been totally expected. In this particular study, they gave graded doses of vitamin E as D-alpha-tocopherol acetate at doses of 70, 140, 560, and 1,050 milligrams. This would be equivalent to 100 up to 1,500 IUs per day of the natural D-alpha-tocopherol. They also gave doses of vitamin C, and vitamin C intakes were found to be in this particular study at about the RDA levels. The normal level of vitamin C that individuals were consuming in their diet were actually below that of normal vitamin C standards by RDA. So these were individuals actually from Scotland. This is from the Rouet Research Institute, Bucksburn, Scotland, in which the standard diets of these individuals were fairly deprived from vitamin C, who were then given supplementary doses, much higher doses of vitamin E. So there was an imbalance between vitamin E intake in the supplemented group and vitamin C intake. Very important part, I believe, of how we're going to interpret the data. They gave the supplements of vitamin E in the graded doses to 50 smokers and 50 non-smokers, and then looked at the erythrocyte vitamin E and red cell membrane components. The red cells of the non-smokers receiving the 1,050 milligram supplement of vitamin E were shown to have a very dramatic increased susceptibility to peroxidation of their red cell. The smokers, however, who were given vitamin E at the doses of 70, 140, 560, and 1,050 milligrams, at every dose given, had a decreased susceptibility of their red blood cells to peroxidation. Therefore, the non-smokers who were not under oxidative stress at high-dose vitamin E intake seemed that the vitamin E had a pro-oxidant effect. Did you hear what I just said? A pro-oxidant effect. This has been discussed in the literature for some time, and it actually goes back in my own experience to research that we published back in the early 1970s, 1973, 1974, on vitamin E supplementation in humans, in which we show that there was a fairly curvilinear response between vitamin E intake and effects on red cell membrane susceptibility to photodynamic oxidation. This is where you take red cells and you expose them to light and oxygen. And we showed that for the average individual, these were college-age students in this particular case, at about 400 milligrams of vitamin E as D-alpha-tocopherol taken daily seemed to be the maximum protective effect against photo-oxidation-induced damage to human red cells. When you get up to 800 to 1,000 milligrams in our studies, we found there was increased oxidative damage, not decreased. Well, this particular Scottish study that I'm describing seems to confirm that same observation, that when you get to very high levels, and I would say above 1,000 milligrams a day of vitamin E for most individuals can be considered a high level, when you give that level of vitamin E to an individual not under oxidative stress as imposed by smoking, that you may increase then the disturbance of oxidoreductive balance in the body, increasing oxidative stress, not decreasing it. And that's what they found in this particular study. And therefore, high levels of vitamin E intake in the non-oxidatively stressed individual seem to have a pro-oxidant effect, and that this obviously might have some deleterious implications. Now, again, I want to mention, and I think it's very important, that when you give a high dose of a specific antioxidant in the absence of balance with others, and particularly in the absence of balance with other redox active substances that are found in fruits and vegetables, you may be tipping then this balance of reduction and oxidation chemistry within cells towards a side that then, whether it's too much oxidation or too much reduction, still results in the promotion of the formation of certain free radicals. And it's that concept of balance that keeps coming through from the recent literature in antioxidant physiology, that the interrelationships of these redox active compounds that are present in a complex diet that can be concentrated from our foods to be given as supplements must exert their effects by appropriate balance. When you get an imbalanced level of a specific antioxidant, you are then looking at a different influence of it on the body. For instance, high doses of ascorbate given therapeutically, this would be vitamin C, may be given in the thousands of milligrams of dose and even intravenously administered at thousands of milligrams per day dose, could have a positive therapeutic benefit not as a normal antioxidant, but as a consequence of its other effects in its donation of ascorbial radicals or ascorbate or dehydroascorbate to intracellular milieu. And it may be this nutritional pharmacological effect of high doses that has specific therapeutic benefit as to be contrasted to a nutritional balance in chemoprotection or nutri protection against disease, in which balance appears to be the principle that we want to maintain, the balance of the antioxidants one to the other. So these two studies, the study that looks at the effect of supplementation of vitamin E, vitamin C, and coenzyme Q10 on oxidative DNA damage as estimated by the formation of 8-oxo-7-8-dihydro-2'-deoxyguanosine excretion, and then the second study, which looked at the effect of vitamin E given in therapeutically graded doses to smokers and non-smokers and the influence it had on erythrocyte membrane oxidative damage, indicates to me that prevention of oxidative stress is achieved best by giving balanced antioxidants at levels that maintain proper redox control, reduction oxidation control within cells. And when we go to very high doses therapeutically of a specific singular antioxidant, we then need to be concerned about the potential imbalance that it may create in that redox balance within cells. And we may use that intentionally for specific therapeutic reasons, but we ought to know what we're doing as we move in that direction to get optimal benefits with the lowest level of potential adverse side effects. Now, this ties together with a story that we started emerging last issue of Functional Medicine Update with Drs. Wright and Gaby, and that was the selenium story, because it's well recognized that selenium plays an important role in preventing disease, cardiomyopathies, for instance, and maybe certain forms of cancer. But at high doses of intake, there have been concern about selenium potentially exerting a toxic effect or, again, being imbalanced with regard to its intake. We have pointed out that those portions of the country that have low soil selenium, portions of the country where grains and other root crop vegetables that require soil selenium for their selenium content, are found to be low in selenium upon the harvest of that particular product. So bread could have low selenium if the cereal grains were grown on low soil selenium. And it's interesting to note, it was pointed out actually almost 20 years ago, that you can map cardiovascular disease incidence around the country against soil selenium levels and show that the highest cardiovascular disease were found in the areas of the country that had the lowest soil selenium. One can go to New Zealand and Australia and analyze the same type of data and see the same types of correlation. I'm now quoting from an interesting article that was published in the January-February 1997 issue of Nutrition Action Newsletter, talking about the selenium surprise article by Bonnie Liebman. Again, indicating that selenium has a very important role to play, apparently, in helping to protect against vascular disorders and possibly cancer, but we ought to be concerned about its dose response and potential adverse imbalances of its intake. Well, we're going to talk about that at some length this month with our clinician slash experimental investigator of the month, Dr. Will Taylor from the University of Georgia. So I'll hold his comments for side two of this month's Functional Medicine Update. But rather, what we'll talk about is selenium in terms of some of the emerging role that it might have in the prevention of viral disorders and possibly even treatment of certain types of viral-induced disorders. The virus, as you know, is rearing back up as a very important disease orchestrator. AIDS has certainly brought this to the attention of the medical and public health communities, that virus illness, and we are starting to see the ever-increasing numbers of books being published on the increasing unusual viruses that are seen around the world and their virulence. One of them that has just started to receive more interesting attention is herpes virus and other related herpes-like viruses, including rabies virus and, as some of you know, even post-polio syndrome, which seem to be interrelated to some of these latent viruses that can then reappear to produce symptoms years later. Probably the deadliest virus that we have ever found, according to a recent article in the Sciences magazine in their January-February 1997 issue, is the rabies virus, which is a very powerful virus that the body may have the opportunity, if the immune system is working up to snuff, to guard itself against in case of infection. But in most cases, it overwhelms the immune system and creates death. And so rabies is certainly a virus that reminds us of the extraordinary virulence of these small, I don't even want to call them organisms, because if you actually ask yourself the question, is a virus alive, it ends up almost being a metaphysical discussion, because as you know, you can crystallize poliovirus and it can survive for centuries without actually changing its architecture. It'd be like crystallizing sodium chloride or table salt. You can do electron micrographic studies of crystallized virus, but yet if you then put it in presence of a vector and it infects a vector, it takes over the molecular machinery of that vector and it starts replicating itself using the machinery of its host as its engine for its own replication. So is the virus really alive? It's almost the question like, what does a tree sound when it falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it? I mean, it's really, I guess, technically not alive. It's not exchanging gases. It's not producing waste products. It's not generating energy until it's in the presence of a appropriate host where it can infect that host and take over its molecular machinery. But on the other hand, we certainly recognize that viruses have the potential to be very infective. Everything from the common cold rhinovirus to the influenza virus, moving on in the extreme case to the rabies virus, shows different degrees of pathogenicity, different organ specificity, and creates in the body the response that we call the alarm inflammatory immune response, that the body is under siege, it's being invaded, and call out the guards and try to do battle with this offender before it takes over our machinery and does us harm. Well, this concept then of a latent virus that sits in our body system without expressing itself as an active infection, but yet is influencing our immune system at some low level, is an interesting concept, because it would be possible that the body's immune system, when reminded that a virus is on board, could continually keep it in check at a low level of infection that would not necessarily produce overt symptoms of infection, but would always have the immune system on guard, always in a chronic state of inflammation. And therefore, one might think about, what is a chronic herpes virus, or what is a chronic Epstein-Barr virus? Does it sit there kind of awaiting for the time that you're under stress, that you haven't been sleeping right, you haven't eaten correctly, you've been suffering from jet lag, and all of a sudden that latent virus that your immune system was kind of keeping in check now suddenly rises up to take control? Could this be post-polio syndrome? Could this be the recurrent herpes infections that people get when they go to Waikiki and suddenly and lay on the beach and they get sun exposure and it changes their immunological potential and now the virus that's always been there in a dormant state comes to life? Interesting questions then about chronic inflammatory conditions and their relationship to chronic viral infection. Well, if you've been following the Alzheimer's disease story, you probably were extraordinarily interested in the recent paper in the Lancet magazine that really picks up on this concept of latent viruses and their influence upon inflammation, including possibly Alzheimer's. This was volume 349, page 241 in 1997. And the title of the article, which I find extraordinarily interesting, is Herpes Simplex Virus Type 1 in Brain and Risk of Alzheimer's Disease. And in this particular study, what they examined was the apolipoprotein E genotype of individuals. Recall, if you would, that the apolipoprotein E, the carrier protein type E that binds various fats in the blood, exists in three common forms in humans, the apolipoprotein E2, E3, and E4. If an individual has a double allele of E2, this is considered the longevity genes, and people in this genetic characteristic can eat virtually anything they want and live a life that might, for most of us mortals, produce a hazard, and for them they seem to be resistant to it. So that's the luck of the draw, the double ApoE2 gene. On the other side of the continuum, however, those that have apolipoprotein E4 double allele, meaning they got one from their mother and one from their father, so they got both characteristics as E4, that is considered the death gene by some investigators because these people have extraordinarily high risk to cardiovascular disease and to Alzheimer's. And therefore, if you're in an E4 characteristic genotype, a double E4, you have a double-barreled risk. You need to really take caution against those risk factors that might contribute to either Alzheimer's or to cardiovascular disease. Well, in this particular study, what they examined was the DNA extracted from 84 samples of brain from 46 Alzheimer's disease patients and 75 samples of brain from 44 non-Alzheimer's disease elderly individuals. They looked at the presence of the ApoE gene type, be it ApoE 2, 3, or 4, and then they tried to correlate that with the expression of disease or non-disease in these individuals as Alzheimer's disease. When they started into this particular study, they were extraordinarily surprised to also find, by doing some other gene amplification work, that there was a considerable presence of herpes simplex virus 1 chronic infection in the brain tissue of these individuals. It would not have been expressed as a diagnosis of a viral disease, but yet there was the latent virus present in a chronic infective state. The HIV-1 positive non-Alzheimer's disease group and the HIV-negative non-Alzheimer's disease group were then compared to the positive and negatives who had Alzheimer's, and that was then compared to their ApoE4 status of their alleles, in other words, their genotype. Well, it's a fairly sophisticated, I know, protocol that I'm describing, but the results, I think, are quite easy to understand. The findings were remarkable. It suggested that the combination of a low-grade chronic herpes simplex virus 1 infection in brain and the carriage of an ApoE4 genotype is a strong risk factor determinant to Alzheimer's disease, whereas either of these features alone did not seem to increase the risk of Alzheimer's disease. Meaning if you had the genetic risk factor of ApoE4, but you did not have the covariable infection with herpes simplex virus 1, which would be producing a state of chronic immunological activation, you did not see statistically increased Alzheimer's disease. However, in individuals that had the ApoE4 and also had the chronic infection with herpes simplex virus 1, you got a very dramatic increase in the incidence of Alzheimer's disease, suggesting that a low-grade chronic immunological activation along with a genetic propensity towards risk gives rise then to the expression of the phenotype which we call Alzheimer's. Now, how could a chronic viral infection have anything to do with a neurodegenerative disease? Well, first of all, I want to implicate that it's possibly not just a viral infection that could activate this process, but it could be toxin exposure, ischemia, it could be other non-viral infections, all of which could activate the immune system of the brain called the glia. The microglia, as you know, is in fact the immunological cells of the brain. they respond to cytokines and chemokines, and they have the effect then upon the brain glia to then increase oxidative reactions and to release nitric oxide and increase potential apoptotic damage or cell death in the neuronal cells of the brain in specific regions where influenced. And therefore, agents that activate brain immunological function or glial cell activity could in fact then contribute to premature aging or death or disease to the brain itself. Carrying the APOE4 genotype and then having a chronic underlying infection could then be covariables that give rise to then the amplification of this process. Exposure to other substances beyond herpes simplex virus 1 could also contribute to this, such as chemical exposures and other immunologically activating processes. Even such things as bovine sphingiform encephalopathy, as you probably know, the BSE mad cow disease, has recently been identified in Science magazine to have come not from a virus, but probably a abnormal prion protein, a small protein that self-replicates that goes directly to the brain and has the influence, again, upon activating an immunological or a cell suicide mission in the brain that causes destruction and results in the spongiform encephalopathy. They've actually been able to show this now in an animal model that the agent responsible for this transmissible spongiform encephalopathy is a malfolded protease-resistant version of prion protein. It has interspecies transmission ability, going meaning it can go from cows to mice or from cows to humans. And in a mouse model of this, they've been able to show serial passage of the prion protein, and it may be involved in species adaptation and may then be an agent involved with the expression of bovine spongiform encephalopathy. So I don't want you to think it's just viruses. There may be many other substances that are passed on that could contribute to amplification of this oxidative stress process in the brain that results, particularly in genetically susceptible individuals, in apoptotic cell death and brain pathology. The correlation of this also with the cardiovascular disease as it pertains to the APOE4 characteristic is also interesting. And as you know, there is an increasing evidence that inflammation may, in fact, also precipitate cardiovascular disease if it's inflammatory conditions of the artery wall. I would urge you to look at the study that was published in JAMA that we reviewed a few issues ago in Functional Medicine Update, in which there was a discussion of women smokers and non-smokers who had bronchitis, indicating that those women with chronic bronchitis, whether they were smokers or not, had a marked increase in the risk and prevalence of coronary heart disease, suggesting, again, there's an underlying relationship between chronic infection and heart disease as well. Well, that then begs the question, if it's not just viruses, what other things might we have to concern ourselves with in functional medicine that might contribute to increased inflammatory processes and cell aging or cell death? Well, one of the areas that we've discussed in previous editions of Functional Medicine Update is Gulf War Syndrome, or so-called Gulf War Syndrome. And I've been very interested in watching the emergence over the past few months of this discussion in the medical literature, and even the government's position on acknowledging that there appears to be something beyond just post-traumatic stress syndrome that has contributed to continued symptoms and very severe symptoms that veterans seem to have had from the participation in the Gulf War conflagration. A series of papers were published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 277, across a number of pages, with titles such as, Is There a Gulf War Syndrome? Searching for Syndromes by Factor Analysis of Symptoms. A second paper, Self-Reported Illness and Health Status Among Gulf War Veterans. A third paper, Self-Reported Exposure to Neurotoxic Chemical Combinations in the Gulf War. A fourth paper entitled Evaluation of Neurologic Function in Gulf War Veterans. And then finally, an editorial that summarizes all of these that's entitled Illness in Gulf War Veterans, Causes and Consequences. And I think you all know what the findings of these papers in combination suggest. They support the hypothesis that clusters of symptoms of many Gulf War veterans represent discrete factor analysis-derived symptoms that appear to reflect a spectrum of neurologic injury involving the central, peripheral, and autonomic nervous systems and are likely traced back to some kind of a toxic exposure yet to be fully identified. And therefore, even though the Department of Defense resisted accepting this as a explanation for symptoms for some time, there does appear to be certainly a cohort of individuals as veterans of this war who are having resonant symptoms as a consequence of the body's response to toxic exposures. And the neurotoxic insults appear to be the most important of these neuro and immunological toxicity. In the study entitled Evaluation of Neurologic Function in Gulf War Veterans, there's a very interesting series of results in which they looked at impaired cognition, confusion, ataxia. They had looked at problems of arthromyoneuropathy. And what they found, again, was there was a generalized injury that seemed to appear in the nervous system of Gulf War veterans that was associated with the expression of these symptoms. Well, as you probably recall, those of you that have been longstanding subscribers to previously Preventive Medicine Update, I reviewed a study that we had done on 26 Gulf War veterans in our own clinical facility in which we did urinary organic acid analysis and cluster statistical evaluation of their data and found that we could separate an almost 100% separation the urinary organic acid patterns of our Gulf War veterans with symptoms versus either reservists or active duty individuals of the same gender and age that were not suffering from Gulf War syndrome from our local Fort Lewis Army and McCord Air Force Base, either active or reservist military people. The separation of their organic acid patterns was so dramatic to me, showing that the service people that had still had the symptoms of Gulf War syndrome had expression of what I called mitochondrial uncoupling, as if their Krebs cycle and their mitochondria, the energy powerhouse of the cell, was uncoupled with increased pyruvate and lactate and citrate and low levels of other downstream Krebs cycle intermediates, decreased ATP. And in fact, there was a very interesting study that was done on these Gulf War veterans also at the Eastern Medical School that had the advantage of being able to do phosphor 31 nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy to look exactly in real time at muscle ATP in these individuals, again confirming very low ATP recharge rates in these people, again as if they had had some imposed mitochondrial injury that had uncoupled their mitochondria and caused energy wasting syndrome and immuno-neurologic and cardiovascular energy deficits. Well, if you examine the literature, you will find a number of papers that confirm that urinary organic acid testing or cerebral spinal fluid or even plasma organic acid testing is very useful for determining metabolic disorders that are related to mitochondrial uncoupling. There's one such paper that was just published in Clinical Chemistry, Volume 43, page 158 in 1997, in which the investigators from the Children's Hospital in Birmingham, England, found that you could, in children, find constitutive mitochondrial defects. These are inherited mitochondrial defects by way of examining fluid organic acid levels, showing elevated levels of lactate and pyruvate and citrate as compared to children of the same age who were not affected. And therefore, I think urinary organic acid profiling is a very useful screening tool for examining the functionality of mitochondria at the gross level in an individual as a screening tool. And it ties together with these symptoms that we associate it with toxic burden or neurotoxic influences or immunotoxic influences, as seen, for instance, in Gulf War. This also ties itself, I believe, to such things as virally induced chronic infection, where there can be alteration in mitochondrial function as a consequence of the upregulation of a specific enzyme that basically causes ATP to be polymerized into poly-ADP and depletes ATP. This is upregulated in the states of immunological activation, where you get increased nitric oxide production, and you get also decreased then ATP levels. So you'll see that as correlated with altered urinary organic acid patterns. So I think the urinary organic acid profile is a useful tool for evaluating aspects of mitochondrial uncoupling and chronic toxic or viral burden and immunological alteration. The implication of this in terms of the story that I'm trying to develop is that not just viral infections themselves, but also toxins that impact the immune and nervous system may also contribute to the symptoms that we associate as fatigue and pain and cognitive dysfunction and immunological changes that we might have said is a virus in origin. And in fact, there's an interesting paper that was just published with chronic fatigue syndrome individuals. This is the Medical Journal of Australia, volume 163, in page 294, in which the investigators from Australia have reported that individuals who are exposed to chlorinated hydrocarbons at high levels have increased evidence in their urine and plasma and cerebral spinal fluid of metabolites that indicate uncoupling of mitochondria, and it's correlated with chronic fatigue syndrome, again suggesting that low-level toxin exposure may result in the exposure of fatigue-like symptoms. Another interesting, I think, clinical relationship between uncoupling energy production systems in the body and the appearance of symptoms of fatigue and cognitive dysfunction. Many of these immunologically activated states that are associated with chronic infection or with toxin exposure may also have inducible increases of nitric oxide synthase, the immune-inducible isoform of nitric oxide synthase, in which nitric oxide is increased in production and urinary nitrate output then is increased as well. In one such study, it was found that you can modulate or modify nitric oxide production in individuals by supplementing them with omega-3 fatty acids. And I think this now starts to provide an interesting link between immune connection to fatty acids and the fatty acid connection to nitric oxide production. We certainly all recognize that nitric oxide is an important signaling molecule in the body, and it would not be fair to call it a bad or deleterious substance. It's needed for cell signaling and immunological defense. But like so many substances that I've been describing earlier, it has a curvilinear dose response. At too low a level, it's not good. At too high a level, it's not good. We want to be in that zone of optimal control, homeodynamic control. And in cases where there's excessive immunological activation, with increased then output of nitric oxide beyond that of desirable, it can be associated with increased oxidative stress and cell damage and mitochondrial uncoupling, as I've described earlier. Essential fatty acids of the omega-3 family, this is EPA, eicosapentaenoic acid, have been found to be able to manipulate the immune-inducible output of nitric oxide. This is a report from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 65, page 459. In this particular study, using a placebo control, and the placebo, by the way, was EPA-free DHA, meaning they had stripped out or extracted out the DHA and EPA from fish oil. So they used a fish oil without EPA and DHA in it versus a fish oil that had 55% of its composition as omega-3 DHA and EPA. And they gave this at doses that were not extraordinarily high. They gave at 3 to 5 gram dose levels, so we're not talking about huge amounts of EPA and DHA. And they followed these individuals, supplement versus placebo, for a period of a few weeks. And they were able to show that there was a significant reduction in the individuals that were supplemented with omega-3 fatty acids in their urinary output of nitrate, meaning that there is an alteration in nitric oxide immune-inducible effects when giving omega-3 fatty acids. So I think that a clinical takeaway from this is that by modulating the fat type of the diet and supplementing with omega-3 fatty acids in individuals with chronic immunological activation and increased output of nitric oxide, that one can move them back towards control and reduce levels of nitric oxide output. We also recognize that individuals who are consuming diets that are high in various antigenic principles that might activate the immune system of the gastrointestinal tract, that this can also increase systemic hyperreactivity and increased chronic inflammation as well. In cases of intestinal hyperpermeability, sometimes called leaky gut syndrome, if you take a person who is prone towards food antigen activity and they feed them the food to which they are responsive or they're allergic, that their intestinal mucosa becomes less able to select friend from foe, and as such, then it becomes more hyperpermeable to larger molecules, middle molecular weight molecules, which then presents to the systemic immune system higher levels of burden that it has to deal with, increasing the potential for inflammation. It also appears to relate to the progression of nephropathy, according to a recent study that was published in the American Journal of Nephrology, volume 16, page 500, that when an individual has a leaky gut or a hyperpermeable intestinal mucosa, and by the way, as you know, you can measure intestinal mucosal integrity of the small intestinal mucosa utilizing the lactulose and mannitol oral challenge test, where you administer orally a dose of two carbohydrates, mannitol, which is a monosaccharide, and lactulose, which is a disaccharide, and then the amount of the carbohydrates that appear in the urine at a period thereafter, and the ratio of one to the other can tell you something about the potential for hyperpermeability across the small bowel mucosa. And therefore, in individuals who have been consuming foods to which they're sensitive, they have increased intestinal hyperpermeability, and that then may play a role in activating systemically the immune system and contribute to IgA nephropathy. This, again, from the American Journal of Nephrology, volume 16, page 500. And by the way, these data in that study were collected over a four-year period, suggesting that in IgA nephropathy, increased intestinal permeability plays a role in the pathogenesis and adversely influences its progression, and that food allergy or antigen exposure to the gut can contribute to this hyperpermeability. So again, I think we talked about viral infections, we've talked about toxin exposures, now we've talked about allergens and their effect upon the lymphoid tissue of the gut and the influence that has on systemic inflammation and specifically on kidney function. Well, we talked about modulating some of this with essential fatty acids of the omega-3 family, but what about the probiotic therapies as well, the so-called econutrition, by treating the gut as an ecological community in which we're trying to balance the immune system and reduce oxidant load and reduce the potential for hyperpermeability of the small bowel? Two interesting reports in this regard. One is on the use of probiotic substances, the Lactobacillus GG species. When they administered that orally to humans that were in an immune-activated state, they saw a lower output of nitric oxide and an alteration in prostacyclin formation as one of the eicosanoids involved with the inflammatory cascade. And the suggestion then is that lactobacillus supplementation in individuals with activated gut mucosal immune systems or lymphoid systems may then actually participate as an antioxidant because it lowers then the immune burden and lowers the oxidant stress. So if you've ever thought about probiotic therapy or what we call the 4R program, and I think most of you who are subscribers know what that stands for, the remove, replace, reinoculate, and repair therapeutic approach. Remove is to remove the offending organisms and foods to which that person's mucosa may be sensitive. And then replace is to add back digestive enzymes and acid to acidify the chyme where necessary if the person is a individual suffering from parietal cell insufficiencies and who requires stomach acid to acidify the chyme, and add digestive enzymes to improve proteolysis and aminolysis and lipolysis. And the third R stands for reinoculate, which is the addition of the lactobacillus and the bifidobacteria and the probiotic substances such as inulin and fructose oligosaccharides that are selective foods for these friendly bacteria. And lastly, repair is to add back those nutrients that are necessary for supportive repair of the gastrointestinal mucosa, which includes things like L-glutamine and pantothenic acid, zinc in a non-irritant form, vitamin E. This clinical adjunctive support program is very helpful for individuals who have gut inflammatory conditions that may be associating themselves in with systemic inflammatory problems, activation of the systemic immune system. Well, we also know that lactobacillus supplementation can modulate things like milk-induced immune inflammatory response in milk-hypersensitive adults. This is a very interesting new paper that I think is quite encouraging because it indicates that by oral supplementation or the use of the 4R program effectively, that one can take foods to which a person might have been sensitive before, like milk, to which a person might have been milk hypersensitive to casein, the principal milk protein, and by proper administration of the 4-hour program, they may be able to reduce then the milk-induced immune inflammatory response and allow that person to be more tolerant to foods to which they were previously sensitive. I'm now quoting from a very interesting article, Nutrition Today Supplement, Volume 31, page 45S, for those of you that want to read more about the modulation of milk-induced immune inflammatory response in milk hypersensitivity in adults by the 4-hour type approach, the eco-nutrition approach. And we know that the oral administration of these agents can actually improve the flora of the gastrointestinal tract. This comes from a very interesting paper published, Journal of Nutrition, Volume 127, page 89, in 1997, that showed the ability of ingested bifidobacteria to actually increase the friendly type of bacteria in the gastrointestinal tract in humans. And the way that they did this was very interesting. They gave a specific strain of bifidobacteria for which they had done DNA karyotyping. And then by fingerprinting in the stool the DNA of bacteria, they were able to demonstrate the survival of this unmodified strain of the bacteria that they had orally administered. So it was not a question of just stimulating the presence of bacteria already in the gut. It was inoculating, as the third R and the four R's, the bowel with the friendly bacteria and making sure that you provide the appropriate nutrition for their growth. That's the fructose oligosaccharides and inulin. Well, welcome once again to our Functional Medicine Update section, Clinician of the Month. And as you know, sometimes we find evidence or research or new information that is so interesting, provocative, and potentially opens up new doors of therapy that even though it's not a clinician, but rather a researcher, we feel it's important to include in this section of Functional Medicine Update. And such is the case this month as we have Dr. Will Taylor from the Computational Center for Molecular Structure and Design, the Department of Medicinal Chemistry at University of Georgia, who is doing some work, as I've reviewed it, that I think is quite extraordinary and certainly opens our mind to a topic that we started in discussing last month in Functional Medicine Update, and that's the selenium story. And when we're reviewing the report on the 200 micrograms of selenium and its relationship to cancer, University of Arizona work, and then the Lavander work on selenium and viral mutations and showing that selenium deficiency resulted in an increased mutational rate in the viral genome, that obviously starts to open up some questions about selenium beyond the traditional views that nutritional scientists may have had, which is selenium is the central cofactor in the enzyme glutathione peroxidase or in the deiodinase enzyme in thyroid hormone metabolism. Maybe there are other roles for selenium in the broad spectrum of regulatory control mechanisms, and that's where we really step off and move into Dr. Will Taylor's extraordinary work. So, Dr. Taylor, I want to welcome you to Functional Medicine Update as a individual who has a background in central nervous system drug design work and more recently over the last 8 years in AIDS research. I would welcome you to our FMU and ask you how you got involved in this work moving from your training and background as a drug designer in pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics and computational pharmacology into the exciting work with selenium and AIDS.
Okay, well, that's a big question. First of all, I appreciate being here and I enjoy the opportunity to get some of this information out to an informed audience. And as far as how I got into this area, my background, as you say, was in CNS pharmacology, and I became interested in why molecules work, why some drugs work effectively against certain receptors or so on, and those skills appeared to be needed in terms of some of the AIDS drug development. And I started working on AZT-like compounds, nucleoside analogs, asking why are some of these effective inhibitors of the virus and many of them not. And that work ultimately led me into a field that is called computational biology, where we try to predict what proteins are encoded in certain genomes and what kind of functions they have and predict their structure ultimately as a goal. And I started looking at the question of drug resistance in antiviral nucleosides and the possible relationship of the RNA structure of HIV to sites of mutation in the viral genome. And it was that process that led me to make some discoveries that I think are fairly significant and interesting. In essence, we discovered some structures called RNA pseudonots in the RNA of the virus. And that in itself was of interest, and where these pseudonots were located were rather interesting. But because pseudonots can be involved in a process called frame shifting, in which new genetic regions can be opened up for translation into protein, we had to ask the question, could this really relate to some new protein coding potential in HIV? And part of that story was that we found these regions had been ignored in the past because of the fact that there were stop codons in this region, or these several regions actually, and people thought therefore anything up there would be junk. But it turns out that stop codons don't always mean stop, and one of the stop codons is known to also encode selenocysteine, an amino acid that incorporates selenium. So there we have the basis in a nutshell of discovering a possible selenium link with HIV, and how we got to that point.
When you started into this this work, obviously it bridges so many different disciplines, and I was intrigued recently in reading a biography on Linus Pauling as to how he had birthed the term molecular medicine, and it was not very well received at the time by either medicine or by biology, because
right.
It didn't seem that it fit tightly into the definitions. You're obviously bridging big gaps in how you are weaving together molecular medicine, molecular biology. How does that relate to the acceptance of some of your concepts and funding and how your research is progressing?
Okay. Well, I think Pauling's work certainly is, I think, an important prototype and precedent for this kind of work. In fact, it was kind of an ironic coincidence that when I made this finding about selenium, which of course is as well known as an antioxidant, and he had done the work with vitamin C and other antioxidants and proposed that they had anti-cancer and antiviral effects. And of course, so there's a parallel here. The irony was that my paper was published in the Journal of Medicinal Chemistry on August 19th, 1994, which was the day Linus Pauling died. So a great tragedy for me was that I never had the opportunity to tell him about this work, which I feel vindicated some of his ideas, because it essentially puts forth a new molecular mechanism of why antioxidants might in some cases have benefits or interactions with viruses. There's further precedent in that this work also was, because it was made from theoretical analyses, essentially we were studying the genomic structure of the virus. We found some molecular structures that were novel or potential molecular structures, and the way they related to the ability of the virus to express protein suggested new protein coding potential or genes or gene variants. And therefore, and from that, what was remarkable, that we were able to actually make an extrapolation or a prediction of a clinical link and something that would actually have clinical significance, namely that the virus could be actually interacting directly with selenium biochemical mechanisms in the body. And when I made that deduction, I went to the medical literature, looked on Medline, and sure enough, there was at least I found initially about 10 papers that had been talking about decline in selenium levels in the progression of HIV disease. So there seemed to be a link there, which made sense, and that made me feel I was on the right track. And what's been gratifying is that in the last couple of years, some very strong new clinical studies have come out suggesting that indeed this isn't just sort of a correlation that of selenium levels in AIDS patients don't just decline as a general marker of their deterioration, but that actually selenium levels appear to be a strong predictor of the outcome and mortality of the disease. And for instance, one paper, the title says that all serum selenium predicts outcome in HIV infection, was published in the Journal of AIDS late in 95, and they essentially showed in about 100 patients that serum selenium levels is strongly correlated with things like opportunistic infections and indeed whether or not patients live or die. And there's numerous studies that are either coming out or have come out fairly recently that have very similar findings. So we feel that certainly suggests that the theoretical analysis should be taken seriously. We also have some experimental data that at least shows some parts of the pieces of the puzzle that we had predicted indeed appear to be holding up. And the theoretical tools and that approach continue to be very powerful, and the most significant advances for my research continue to come out of the theoretical analysis. For instance, just this month, we realized that one of the potential genes that we predicted in HIV is indeed a glutathione peroxidase gene, and we use this by sort of state-of-the-art methods of comparative sequence analysis, and we can prove that the statistical similarity of this region of HIV to glutathione peroxidase is highly, highly significant. And this is important because, as you pointed out in the beginning, glutathione peroxidase is the prototype mammalian selenium-containing protein, and therefore this isn't just an arbitrary possible gene we're pointing out here. This is an obvious homolog of a known selenoprotein. This is also supported or made more believable by the fact that last August, a group from the National Institutes of Health discovered a glutathione peroxidase gene in another virus, a pox virus called molluscum contagiosum. And that is a large DNA virus, and this was an unmistakable homolog of glutathione peroxidase that was like about 80% similar at the amino acid level. So there's definite precedent now for glutathione peroxidases being encoded in viruses. So it opens up many, many interesting questions as far as what does the virus benefit by having a glutathione peroxidase gene? What does that imply for the interactions between the host and selenium? And how can this be used to explain the clinical findings, which are now accumulating very strongly, showing a link between selenium and HIV disease progression?
Well, now, with that in mind, let me, if I can, play the roles of our listeners just for a sec, who are in the main not molecular biology specialists. You've talked about the correlation of low selenium with the progression of AIDS. You've indicated in your publications that selenium depletion occurs irrespective of the presence or absence of diarrhea or gastrointestinal malabsorption, and that low selenium intake in the diet doesn't appear to be the cause of this low selenium
right.
status.
Right.
And we know that associations do not necessarily mean cause and effect. Putting this all together, could you give us your interpretation of how these correlates might relate to cause and effect relationships?
Okay, well, there's a number of fairly difficult conceptual questions here that I think people have problems with, because all the clinical evidence points in the direction that selenium deficiency appears to accelerate progression of the disease, that it seems to actually be worse. And that's somewhat paradoxical, because if I'm saying that, hey, the virus actually uses selenium somehow, the first thing people think is, well, then if you take selenium, couldn't that be bad? Wouldn't that be feeding the virus and making the virus grow better? And yet that appears, not to be the case, because it's not only HIV, but a number of other viral diseases have been shown to be strongly correlated with low selenium levels or increased virulence, as in the case of the Coxsackie virus. You mentioned the Levander and Beck work that has shown that the virus mutates more rapidly into a more virulent form in selenium deficiency. And we've actually found a potential glutathione peroxidase-like region in Coxsackie virus as well, so we think this is a sort of a general picture. But in any case, I think the key thing, the concept here is how exactly is the virus using selenium, and if it is indeed making a protein that contains selenium, what is the function of that protein? And for instance, let's talk about glutathione peroxidase. Glutathione peroxidase is essentially an antioxidant that will break down hydrogen peroxide and lipid peroxides, and thus potentially reverse the lipid peroxidation and ultimately reduce the oxidant tone in a cell. And it is well known, very well established by many studies, that increased free radical levels, increased oxidant tone, oxidative stress in a cell actually increases, stimulates the replication of HIV. So, therefore, it would appear that if you increase glutathione peroxidase levels in a latently infected cell, at least, that you could be, that would be expected to reduce or inhibit the replication of HIV. So that would suggest that perhaps the virus could use such a protein to actually have a negative feedback control upon its own replication. And there are numerous examples where in complex biological systems where we have both positive and negative controls. Everyone tends to think of a virus as, oh, it's just out to get you, it's just going to take over, and all it wants to do is replicate, and therefore why would it want to have any kind of a way of slowing itself down? But that's a very simplistic and I think unrealistic attitude, because all complex biological systems have both positive and negative regulatory mechanisms. And other repressor type of mechanisms are known to exist in certain viruses. The virus, for example, could be using a selenoprotein like glutathione peroxidase to monitor selenium status in the host cell. And if host selenium levels lower, then it would not be able to make its GTX, so it would be less inhibition of free radicals, and the virus would replicate more. That could be a response. It could be using this in a way to kind of monitor, well, if selenium levels are low in the host, that probably means the host's immune system is compromised. So that would be a good time for the virus to have a higher profile and replicate more. Whereas if host selenium levels are high, that will probably be an indicator that the host cellular immunity is functioning at a higher level, and the host might be able to more effectively kill virus-infected cells, etc. So, therefore, the virus is essentially using selenium to monitor, perhaps, the selenium status of the host to make a decision as to whether it's good to lie low or whether it's good to replicate at a higher level. So it's a little bit of a convoluted argument. I've used the analogy that perhaps the virus could use a selenoprotein as a sort of a birth control pill. When selenium is abundant, it makes more of this and it inhibits itself. And if selenium becomes depleted, it perhaps sees this as a better time to replicate at a higher level. And this certainly does make sense in terms of there's a lot of evidence showing that selenium is very important for cellular immunity, which is the type of immunity that the body uses to combat cancer cells and virus-infected cells. So I guess there's maybe some other types of analogies or arguments you could make as to why a virus might have a glutathione peroxidase. I'll mention just one other. The immune system also uses free radicals to kill cells that it's trying to eliminate using the cellular immunity mechanism. One of the mechanisms of cellular immunity, there's sort of direct cytolysis by perforation of cells, but there's also initiation of something called apoptosis, programmed cell death, where the T cells will detect that a cell is infected or that a cell is cancerous, and it will initiate a cell death process. And typically those processes can involve unleashing free radicals in the cell. So here's perhaps another rationale of why a virus might want to have glutathione peroxidase or an antioxidant enzyme. It could possibly combat this attack by the immune system, keep the cell alive longer, and give itself an opportunity to make virions and escape from that cell and carry on before that cell is killed. But ultimately, the key factor, I think, has to be there is a balance of power between the virus and the immune system, and the clinical evidence on selenium seems to suggest that whatever the virus is doing with selenium, we probably appear to be to benefit by having a somewhat higher selenium status than a low selenium status.
I'm very intrigued by your both observations and explanation. This latter discussion you had about apoptosis and the immune system using free radicals as a virucidal agent, and that possibly there's a chemoprotective mechanism by the virus having glutathione peroxidase that it can upregulate, leads me to, another alternative explanation, and maybe you've discarded this as not possible, but could it be that the prototypical GSH peroxidase homolog that's produced in these HIV organisms is using up available selenium from the extracellular matrix, and that depletes then the host cell selenium, making it more susceptible to oxidative stress, so that basically you have the virus using up the selenium, making
right.
then the lower selenium on the host be
right.
the problem?
Well, that was certainly one of the key initial ideas that we proposed, and in fact, we do believe this is going on. In particular, one of the places in HIV where we have found a very highly conserved UGA codon and potential selenoprotein coding potential is a gene of HIV called the NEF gene. And in the paper that we published in 1994, we mentioned this as a possible culprit in causing selenium depletion in host cells because of the fact that this UGA codon that can potentially be translated as selenocysteine in this particular gene is sort of directly in line. It doesn't require one of these frameshift events or other inefficient events. And therefore, if you had overexpression of this NEF protein of HIV in cells, that consequence of that could be depletion and sequestering of selenocysteine. And we're particularly interested in with a collaborator, Dr. Benjamin Bloomberg at University of Rochester Medical Center. We've been examining the possibility this could be play a role in the CNS pathology of HIV because they had previously shown that when HIV infects certain brain cells like astrocytes, it gets into an abnormal life cycle. It sort of gets like a stuck record. It gets stuck at a certain phase of its life cycle. It makes a lot of this NEF protein, overexpresses it at very high levels, and therefore that could lead to serious depletion of selenocysteine and then an antioxidant defect in those cells, which would be consistent with the cell death that is characteristic of some of the encephalopathy that is seen in the CNS pathology of AIDS. So we're investigating that, and we're trying to prove that there are that selenoprotein coding potential does in fact exist in this NEF gene. And we have a paper, in fact, under review, so I can't really talk about our experimental evidence there. But we believe that gene may well be a particular culprit for doing the kind of thing you're suggesting, actually depleting the host selenium, certainly within certain cells. We're not sure if this kind of mechanism is really enough to account for the total amount of selenium loss or depletion seen in HIV patients. It's hard to say if the total body load of virus, even with the supposedly high levels of viral turnover that have been suggested in recent years by the work of Dr. Ho and other researchers, it's hard to say there's enough HIV around that it could really cause a significant or dramatic decline in blood levels. On the other hand, there is new evidence that selenium does play a critical role in T cells, and there's one other new paper I want to mention that I think is very important. This work was by researchers at something called the DNAX Institute in California. They published a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences just before Christmas sometime. And their paper is about the discovery of a new selenoprotein gene, which is a gene encoding something called selenophosphate synthetase, which is the key enzyme to generate the bioactive form of selenium, which is selenophosphate. Selenophosphate is what is used to make selenocysteine. And the key thing I want to mention about their findings was they showed that this particular gene is upregulated in activated T cells. And they go on to suggest that this gene and selenobiology in general is a very important component in blood cells in general, and obviously in T cells. And what's striking about that finding is that it's been known for years that HIV will only replicate well in activated T cells, suggesting that HIV, when HIV likes to replicate, is when selenocysteine is being synthesized at high levels in the cell. So yet another link between T cells and selenium and the potential, the fact that HIV just happens to like to infect these cells or replicate in these cells when they're optimally revved up for making selenocysteine and selenoproteins. So I think we're going to find that there are probably some novel selenoproteins in T cells, so part of the loss of selenium that we see with progression of AIDS could be just because T cells are dying by whatever mechanisms, direct and indirect cell killing. Dr. Ho and others have talked about this high rate of turnover of T cells during HIV infection, this sort of battle between the immune system and the virus. And if we're really losing billions of T cells every day in advanced HIV disease, which is what they suggest, we could be losing a lot of selenium because selenium is concentrated in T cells and used in ways that we don't yet completely understand. What I'm saying is I think there's more going on than just glutathione peroxidase in these immune cells, and until we really understand what all of those functions are, we don't really understand what it's doing.
Given this very exciting correlative and observational and computational work, are there any at present animal studies that have shown that selenium supplementation results in either lower viral load or replication rate of any viral species?
Well, one of the problems is there we don't have a really good animal model for HIV. To my knowledge, no one's done any selenium work with primates and simian immunodeficiency virus. However, there are some very provocative studies with the mouse mammary tumor virus, which were conducted by Dr. Gerhard Schrautzer, formerly of the University of California at San Diego. He's recently retired, but still active in his own institute. But Dr. Schrautzer showed way back in the late 70s that the mouse mammary tumor virus, which is a retrovirus, was very significantly inhibited by dietary, just increasing the dietary level of selenium. And this, he was interested in this as a model for breast cancer, because obviously that's mouse mammary tumors, or the mouse equivalent of breast tumors. And his studies, he published a whole series of papers showing this was a very dramatic effect. The reduced incidence of mammary tumors with selenium supplementation was considerable. Unfortunately, a lot of people in the cancer research field didn't take that very seriously, or that, you know, suggested that maybe this isn't a very good cancer model because the virus models of cancer have become unfashionable, and chemical carcinogenesis models are maybe more relevant. It's kind of ironic because last year or so, a new study came out showing that about 40% of, close to 40% of human breast cancers could be, they showed that sequences homologous to the envelope gene of mouse mammary tumor virus could be detected in about 38% of human mammary tumors. So, and this was apparently very specific. They did a lot of studies, a lot of controlling to show that this wasn't some endogenous retrovirus sequence or something. So that kind of gives new life to the possible viral, oncogenic virus theory of cancer. But in any case, it was a very clear-cut example where a retrovirus relative of HIV was inhibited by selenium in vivo. And in fact, there's a few older studies showing a couple like a bovine leukemia virus where they showed selenium had an antiviral effect in the test tube. There were certainly some in the test tube studies showing that selenium, for instance, a French study was published in late 94 showing in the test tube, selenium inhibited the reactivation of latent HIV infections in cells in response to hydrogen peroxide or other stimulants. And they interpreted that as just that while they were giving selenium, it was going to increase the levels of host glutathione peroxidase in these cells, and that that would then reduce oxidative stress, and there would be less activation of HIV replication. And that certainly is probably going on, but it's also possible that there is some more direct interaction of the virus with selenium along the lines I'm proposing. But certainly it suggests that there is in vitro, in the test tube, evidence that selenium will inhibit HIV in cell culture models.
I also remember, I believe about 10 years ago, that there was a paper published in Science magazine in which the investigators had reported the results of four or five different types of selenium that they administered to animals that have Ehrlich ascites tumors, and showing that selenium dioxide and sodium selenate had a very powerful anti-tumor effect. Do you recall that study?
Yeah, that was a study that I'm not familiar with. Of course, the whole selenium and cancer story is another big story that has become very exciting recently, finally, with this Clark study from University of Arizona, showing that, in fact, you know, in humans, supplementation, you know, over really a fairly short-term study in cancer terms, that there really was a significant anti-cancer effect. And that really confirms Chinese studies, several studies in Chinese populations that had shown a significant anti-cancer protective effect of selenium supplementation. The interesting link there, I think, with viral diseases is that cells or cellular immunity is the part of the immune system that the body uses versus both cancer and viral infections. Because in both cases we have cells, in one case that have been taken over by a virus, in another case that have been taken over by, essentially mutations that lead to loss of control of the growth regulation in cancer cells, and the body needs to kill those cells, whether it's infected or whether it's cancerous, and the cellular immunity and T cells take part in that. And so there is a link, and so if selenium somehow boosts cellular immunity against cancer, it's not unreasonable that it would boost cellular immunity against viruses, and vice versa. And then the other possibility is that maybe viruses, there's still a bit of a role for viruses in certain types of cancers that may be a larger role than people currently think or that is currently fashionable. And certainly this finding about apparent homologs of the mouse mammary tumor virus in human breast cancers is a very provocative suggestion of a possible link or more of a role for viruses. But I think it's certainly reasonable that selenium will have the fact that it's so effective in certain cancers certainly suggests that it's worth investigating, that it may have a lot of potential versus viral infections as well. But the clinical studies that really need to be done, say with HIV or other viral diseases, just only very small provocative kind of retrospective analyses have been done. You know, people have looked at populations where selenium data was available, and then they've showed that, hey, selenium actually correlated with the outcome of HIV infection in this population. But they have not done the equivalent of the Clark study in HIV patients, and such studies are now being proposed. There is one group that is proposing to do such studies, and I hope that more such studies will be undertaken because, they take time, and there's a lot of things to control for. People are taking all these antiviral drugs and so on, and it's not going to be an easy thing to prove. But based on all the preliminary data and preliminary studies, I'm pretty confident there will be a benefit of selenium supplementation versus a number of viral diseases, including HIV, and I think that's very consistent with Linus Pauling's ideas about orthomolecular medicine and the benefits of antioxidants.
That's a wonderful close. I have one last question to bear on your background and expertise in both medicinal chemistry and in pharmaceutical chemistry. Given that we've also learned that selenium has a fairly narrow dose response margin of safety, it's one of those elements that can be toxic at increased levels, and that the Arizona study was discussing a 200 microgram per day dose, which is quite a bit higher than the estimated daily intake of the National Research Council Food Nutrition Board. Do you have any sense in average human beings as to what the safe range of selenium might be?
I think there's absolutely no potential harm to supplementing with 200 micrograms per day. My personal feeling is that some of the concerns about toxicity have been exaggerated, although I guess there's always crazy people who will go out there and just take, 100 times the RDA of something if they think it's going to have a benefit, and those people need to really be discouraged. And anyone, especially who's got a serious health condition like AIDS or HIV infection, really needs to consult with their physician, and that's what I strongly encourage. There has been some short-term studies where even higher amounts, like 400 micrograms, were given daily for periods of time. There's also a very provocative Chinese study where they used selenium in pharmacological doses against hemorrhagic fever. There was an outbreak of hemorrhagic fever in a region of China in the late 80s, apparently, and they treated it with 2 milligrams of selenite per day, which would be about 10 times higher than the dose used in the Clark study. And that would certainly be a toxic dose if you were to continue that dose indefinitely. You'd get chronic toxicity. But they just gave it for 10 days. They gave this 2 milligram a day dose. There was a dramatic reduction in mortality in this outbreak of hemorrhagic fever with this treatment. So that certainly suggests there was at least a potential or a prospect for use of pharmacological doses rather than nutritional doses. But if that is done, it has to be done over a very finite time frame to avoid any long-term toxicity concerns.
Dr. Taylor, I really want to thank you, and I know that there will be a number of our listeners who will be interested in following up. Is there a place they can write or fax you if they want to get a bibliography or more information from you?
Yeah, well, certainly they can contact me by email at wtaylor@rx.uga.edu. That's probably one way. They could also contact me by fax at area code 706-542-5358. So that would probably be the most workable approaches.
That's great, and we'll make sure that both your email and your fax number get on the summary cards at the end of this month's tape. And I personally want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to share your very exciting work with us and to open our minds to the potential that the selenium may have beyond that of the traditional nutritional roles, looking at it from an immunological and a cell replicative perspective. And keep up the great work.
Okay, well, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I would like to close this month's Functional Medicine Update with a clinical focus on the new emerging understanding of the field of weight gain and weight loss. There's some exciting things happening on the horizon, and some of you certainly are aware of the fact this field is being stimulated by the first drug that's ever been approved for the treatment of obesity, in this whole FinFin program, which is gaining great revolutionary review within medicine, everyone looking for the quick fix to the more difficult problem. But I think from this comes a very extraordinary story that I hope I can summarize for you in the last 10 minutes of this month's Functional Medicine Update. I'm now really quoting from a review article by Dr. Albert Stunkard, who is one of the world's renowned experts on obesity, that recently discusses current views on obesity and how they're changing. This is from the American Journal of Medicine, Volume 100, and page 99, in which Dr. Stunkard is talking about the fact that we now recognize that not all conditions of overweight are a consequence simply of eating too many calories, the old first law of thermodynamics, too many energy in calories and not enough energy out in the way of activity. Now he's talking much more about the fact that there are metabolic states within individuals' processing of calories that may relate to how they store or lose or maintain certain body mass sectors, particularly body fat. And that the whole thermogenesis story as it relates to heat production from food calories and how that's controlled by hormones and neurotransmitters and neuromodulators, how that then interrelates with the function at the organelle that we've described already in this month's Functional Medicine Update, the mitochondria, is becoming an exciting new story that takes us beyond just the simple application of the first law of thermodynamics. Well, that leads us then to the whole question of pharmacological aspects of obesity treatment as we move into the 21st century. I'm now quoting from the International Journal of Obesity, supplement number 3, page 51, under the title of Pharmacological Aspects of Obesity, because if we can identify agents that in fact regulate the way that our body controls the metabolism of calories in ways that would normalize calorigenic responsiveness of cells, particularly mitochondria, that we might then be able to help individuals who are genetically inclined or have had induced effects upon energy metabolism in such a way as they're altering their metabolic sufficiency or thermogenesis and increasing then their regulatory set point for calories in versus activity units out or even heat out, which is a very silent, non-polluting way to get rid of excess fat calories, isn't it, to produce heat as a byproduct. Again, however, as I read this article by John Blundell and Jason Halford, I'm reminded that this concept of pharmacological approach to increasing thermogenic responsiveness may be at the last stage what is required for certain people, but maybe there are certain things that we could do prior to giving pharmacology so as to reduce potential adverse side effects, because whenever we're using a medication to increase metabolic activity, we are running the risk of other adverse side effects from tinkering with the metabolism. And I think the emerging part of the non-pharmacological approach towards body weight normalization and body fat composition normalization has to do with the increasing story around insulin resistance. And I was very intrigued by the paper by Dr. Robert Eckel in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 65, page 164, 1997, in which he talked about insulin resistance and its relationship to weight gain and to adipocyte depot storage and to hypertension and atherosclerosis risk, suggesting that there is something about insulin resistance, insulin sensitivity, and this thermogenesis and metabolic control of calories to energy. I was further intrigued by the story when I saw the paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 335, page 1357, in which there was the discussion of the glucose transport phosphorylation cycle and muscle glycogen synthesis after exercise in insulin-resistant subjects, again showing that there are some very significant differences in metabolic function as it relates to how insulin interrelates with glycogen synthesis and storage within muscle, and how that influences then energy production upon training or exercise in individuals who carry this insulin-resistant characteristic. They tend to be metabolically blunted, so to speak, and less able to convert stored energy in the form of glycogen or triglycerides into energy of activity than individuals who do not carry this insulin-resistant characteristic. So again, I come back to this insulin resistance component as emerging to be something of interest in the way we view this. Well, how do you measure insulin resistance? And as you probably know, there are a variety of techniques that have been used, the insulin clamp technique probably being the most diagnostically specific but the most problematic and invasive. Second is the glucose tolerance test, looking at postprandial serum insulins and glucoses at 3 and 5 hours after a glucose load. Again, for most clinicians, that's a fairly complicated procedure that can be done in office, but it requires holding the patient for several hours. The third, probably less diagnostically specific but more easily applied technique, is to measure glycosylated hemoglobin levels. How does this correlate then with the oral glucose tolerance test? Well, as you know, the gold standard for the diagnosis of diabetes and insulin insensitivity has been the oral glucose tolerance test and the glucose tolerance test with postprandial insulin. Recently, however, as reported in The Lancet, volume 349, page 223 in 1997, there's the increasing recognition that hemoglobin A1C, glycosylated hemoglobin levels, that are in the upper 5% of normal and above are considered indicative of poor insulin sensitivity and glucose intolerance and are indicative of poor glucoregulation, so-called dysglycemia. And therefore, a test that we might have looked at 15 years ago and then kind of thrown away because we thought it had little clinical value, we're now coming back to recognize has significant potential value as a screening tool for insulin insensitivity. So the glycosylated hemoglobin, hemoglobin A1C, in the upper 5% of normal, say that's between 6.4 and 7% glycosylated hemoglobin in the blood, is indicative then of potential insulin insensitivity. And one might say, well, what about looking at other shorter-term indicators rather than the 120 days of the red cell and its relationship to glycosylated hemoglobin? Why don't we look at glycosylated albumin, for instance, which has a much shorter lifetime? And it is true that we can look at glycosylated albumin, and it does give us a much closer timeline of dysglycemia and insulin insensitivity, but most labs don't routinely run glycosylated albumin, and therefore my suggestion from this data is the more available and less expensive glycosylated hemoglobin, hemoglobin A1C, might be considered useful. As this type of work is done, what is found is that there is a very close correlation between insulin insensitivity and its relationship to imbalances in leptin. Leptin, as you know, is emerging as a neuroactive chemical communicator, mediating the effects of food intake and on hypothalamic activity, and appears to be associated in some way with obesity, alterations in leptin synthesis and leptin activity, a down-regulated leptin production. It also turns out that there is a modulation of insulin activities by leptin, and so there's an interrelationship between leptin control in the brain and the ultimate effect that it may have on glucose tolerance and insulin sensitivity. By the same token, one might see that there are leptin-insensitive individuals who are producing super high levels of leptin and have the most resistant insulin. So it's not just low leptins are associated with impaired metabolism and reduced satiety signaling, but it's also leptin resistance, just like the insulin-resistance scheme where you can have too high of insulin or you can have too low of insulin, both associated with dysglycemias. What is leptin for and does it act on the brain? That's an interesting question. And recently in Nature Medicine, there is a report in Volume 2, page 492 in 1996, talking about the role in which leptin has been found to have in animals and how its receptor site relates to satiety and control of not only appetite and calorie intake, but also to certain metabolic aspects of the controls of calories through the insulin modulation. So leptin certainly may have some contribution to obesity and its interrelationship to glucose intolerance, but by the same token, glucose intolerance and insulin insensitivity may also feed back to have impact upon leptin synthesis as well. It seems to be a biphasic push-pull type mechanism. So obesity, leptin in the brain, interrelated, obesity, leptin in the insulin sensitivity and adipocyte tissues. This is from February 1st issue of the New England Journal of Medicine in 1996. In Pima Indians who have insulin insensitivity, it's been found that they have both low leptin concentrations and some super high leptin concentrations, indicating leptin insensitivity. I'm now quoting from Nature Medicine, Volume 3, page 238 in 1997. And cerebrospinal fluid leptin levels also show relationship to plasma levels and adiposity in humans, again, with low and high leptins being associated with increased adiposity and insulin insensitivity with the high leptin individuals. So the point I'm really driving from this discussion is that if one can control insulin sensitivity by dietary intervention, utilizing a higher protein to carbohydrate dietary ratio, increasing chromium, increased vanadium intake, and increased activity levels, that there may be significant improvement then in satiety, metabolic thermogenesis, and reduction in need for the introduction of things like FinFin and other pharmacological agents that could have adverse side effects. For those of you that are interested in following up on this, I've written a recent review entitled New Advances in Weight Management that takes these concepts into account. If you're interested, you can give us a call at 800-843-9660, and we'll be happy to send you a reprint of this article that describes how this can be employed in a clinical management program utilizing these dietary variables to try to re-stimulate insulin sensitivity and have a positive impact upon leptin-modulated function and thermogenesis. I hope this is an intriguing review of the current state of obesity research and might give you some approaches that you're not now exploring towards proper weight management in these patients. Look forward to talking with you in June. Thanks a million for being with us.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by HealthCom International Incorporated of Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.